Well, greetings everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour Editorial. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabel, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally and internationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 112 countries worldwide over the Internet. Now, for more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on incorrigible delinquency when we come back. Well, how many laws did Moses give us in the Mosaic Law? And how many laws has our state given us in our secular government? Well, Moses gave us 759 statutes, judgments, and commandments, and the state, at last count, gave us 2.5 million laws, and they're adding to it at the rate of 47 pages a day at the federal level. Now, the Apostle Peter said that we ought to obey God rather than men, and he said that in Acts 5, verse 29. And our Congress reaffirmed that and said that we ought to voluntarily apply the teachings of the Scripture in the lives of families, individuals, and societies. And they did that in Public Law 97-280. And our Supreme Court has said that there is a higher loyalty than loyalty to this country, and that is loyalty to God. And they said that in Seeger versus United States. Now, you know, every authority is in agreement. The Congress, the Supreme Court, and God Almighty Himself have all affirmed that the Scriptures are the final authority on law. Now, if you'd like to learn these 500 or 759 statutes, judgments, and commandments and how to use them against government intrusion into your God-given rights, it's a right, it's a duty, it's an obligation that we owe to ourselves, our families, and our society. And we teach these 759 statutes, judgments, and commandments here at the law school, along with the penalties now for the violation of these laws, and we do it twice a year. So why don't you make it a point to regain your First Amendment right to free exercise this year, and that First Amendment right is the gateway to your Second Amendment rights, and indeed, to your whole Bill of Rights. Now, the law of God may be old, but it's not old-fashioned, and it's very relevant to our lives, and it's very relevant to our rights today. Now, if you'd like to learn more, why don't you call and order our free general law CD package? That's a 4-hour commentary on the law in general, and it's educational, informative, it's entertaining, best of all, it's free. And you can call and order one right now. The number's 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, our Mosaic Law School is also available now on compact disc for adult home study. And if you're online, you can go to our website, georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org, O-R-G. Just click onto the email and send us an email request for that free general law CD package. Again, that's georgegordon.org, or call us direct at 417-273-4967. Do it right now while you're thinking about it before you forget. All right, we're talking about this thing. The conversation this week is about incorrigible delinquency. And so I showed you some of the ins and outs here of this thing called delinquency. We talked about the Muslims. I showed you we have a Muslim man here in Missouri that's locked up for killing his daughter. She was a wayward daughter, and he determined for himself, he and his wife determined that that girl needs killing, and they killed her. And not just by himself, no. He did it with the help of the rest of the family members. It was a family execution of a child that they deemed to be incorrigible. Then I showed you in the scripture that that power was conferred by God through Moses to the Israelites out at Mount Sinai. And if you had an incorrigible child, the one that would not practice, would not obey the fifth commandment, honor your father and mother, smited or cursed his father or mother, then he could be put to death. And then there was a regime, there was a statutory remedy or provision for doing just that. Where did that power come from? The power of parents. The literal power of parents to have life and death control over their children. Well, it comes from the doctrine or the practice of strict liability. Strict liability. The opposite to strict liability is called limited liability. Limited liability is insurance. Now, here in the Western world, we practice insurance. It's an admiralty practice. It used to be practiced just by the merchants of the Hanseatic League, just by the wealthy, the merchants, the nobility, the king practiced limited liability. But it has now spread throughout society. Indeed, it's spread throughout the world. Nearly every society in the world has its insurance program. Here in the United States, we have insurance commissioners, and we have all of the states empowered to regulate and to license this thing of insurance. Insurance is a regulated and licensed industry. It's a licensed or permitted practice or business. Now, when we look up the word license, just go to any law dictionary and look up the word license, it is permission to do something that's otherwise illegal, unlawful, a tort, or trespass. So a license then is by law, a definition of law. It is permission to break the law. It is a controlled mechanism by which we are going to break a law. And indeed, we have a maxim of law, one of the 400 maxims, that goes right along that line. If you're going to break the law, you have to have a reason why. So if you're going to break a law, you have to have a reason why. So let's suppose you're driving down the road at 110 miles an hour and the policeman roars up behind you and he flashes you with his lights. And the speed limit here in this area maybe is 55 or 60 or 70. Here you're going 110. And so you stop, and then the policeman comes up to your window and he says, "No, listen, son, how come you're driving 110 miles an hour?" And you say, "Well, in the back seat of my car is my wife. Can you see her there?" "Yeah." "Can you see that she's in agony and that she's laying on the seat over there and she's moaning and groaning?" "Yeah." "Okay. Well, her water broke and she's in labor and she's about to have a baby and I'm hustling myself to the hospital, you know, before the baby's born in the back seat. That's why I was going 110 miles an hour. Now, son, why don't you get out there in front of me and why don't you turn on your lights and lead me to the hospital?" Now, there's an example, kind of a wild example, of if you're going to break the law, you got to have a reason why. Now, most people say, "Well, I was in a hurry to get to work." "Well, then why didn't you leave 15 minutes earlier?" "Or I'm on my way to the blue room to have a couple of drinks." "Well, again, you know, why didn't you leave 15 minutes earlier?" See, that's not much of a reason. I'm on my way to work to be driving 110 miles an hour. But on your way to the hospital, you know, if somebody cut their arm off and you're rushing them to the hospital or something, that would be a reason to be driving a little over the speed limit. Now, the same thing is applicable to any avenue or any other application of law. If there's a reason why you're doing this, and, you know, it can be justified by reason, logic, and common sense, no judge is going to lock you up and punish you because you're doing something that needs to be done. Now, in 1862, President Lincoln enacted what we call today the Emancipation Proclamation, and it effectively ended bond servitude here in the United States. And then, if you take a look around the world, bond servitude has been pretty well eliminated around the world. Another factor that comes into here, or comes into the discussion here, along with bond servitude, and this thing of slavery comes into play here. Now, slavery is distinct from bond servitude, but in both cases, the bond servant and the slave is owned by his master. It's a master-servant relationship, and there's an ownership. There's a property right involved here, and property is the holy grail of Anglo-Saxon administration. Property. Now, most people would say, "Oh, no, it's life." No. Life is an important corollary to it, but you see, your life is your property, and that's why our Constitution guarantees your right to life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness. Pursuit of happiness came from John Locke, and Thomas Jefferson used John Locke's phrase, life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness. It was John Locke that said life, liberty, and property. And he got that from the Ten Commandments in the Mosaic Law. You see, God guarantees, God grants, God gives, this creator of the universe, this is the guy. I'm not talking about Buddha now and Allah and all these other gods out there, you know, Mars and Jupiter and all the rest. I'm talking about the creator, you know, the guy that did the Adam and Eve trick in the Garden of Eden, that guy. Okay, now he's the guy that sets down these laws. He grants you these liberties, kind of like my dad did. He gave me a bicycle, my dad did, and they took it away from me. I remember one time he said, "You're grounded, you're walking. No bicycle for a week." Well, that was a tough trick because I had a paper route and I had to walk that whole paper route. Oh, that was terrible. That was the worst. At the time, when you're 12 years old, that's the worst punishment that you could imagine. Grounded, no wheels, walking. But that illustrated to me a very important point. The question arose, who owned that bicycle? Well, my dad owned the bicycle because he also owned me. Well, at least he thought he did. My dad, I think he honest to God thought he owned me. I was an issue from his body and my mother's body. Those two people, my mother and father, created me. And, you know, they kind of thought that probably that's our property, that kid's probably mine. Now, owning children is a little bit different than owning bicycles and automobiles and snow machines and the, you know, rights like life, liberty, and property. And by the way, your rights are also property. So if you have a right to something, like a right to vote, which really is a civil right, you don't have a right to vote, but you have a civil right, and we call it a right, it's really a privilege, it's a franchise. Voting is a franchise, it's not really a true right. And so oftentimes in our language here, we use words that are inappropriate to describe things. For instance, we use the word cash. How did you pay for that big screen TV? Well, I paid cash. No, I didn't. He went into Best Buy, he bought the big screen TV, and he discharged the obligation with Federal Reserve notes. He did not pay cash. And if you look up the word cash in a legal dictionary, it'll tell you gold and silver coin. Gold or silver coin. So there is a thing called cash, and then there's a thing that we call cash, and then they're not the same. And that's a perversion of language. Now, in court, we don't do that. In court, when you come in and you say you paid cash, the judge is thinking gold and silver coin. And then in your testimony, we find out that you didn't pay cash, you lied, you were a perjurer, you actually discharged the obligation with commercial paper called Federal Reserve Notes or some other form of commercial paper. And the judge says, well, wait a minute. There's a legal difference between commercial paper and discharge and real money and gold and silver. So the outcome of your case rests upon the testimony and the definition of these words. No, the definition of words is very important. Not in modern America. I mean, we here in America are practically functionally illiterate, unable to speak. Now, let me give you an illustration of that. One time I was in court, and Judge Schmidt asked me how I pled, and I said, I'm going to reserve my plea, and I don't want to enter a plea at this time. He said, well, you want to put the pressure on me. He said, well, we need a plea here. Do you want to plead guilty or not guilty? I said, I'm going to withhold my plea. You see, I don't understand the charges. And until I've had an opportunity to code plead it out, and and come to a conclusion, maybe secure counsel and look this over. For instance, you know, when you get a complaint, there may be some words in there that you don't understand. You know, words like cash. You know, well, what does the word cash mean? Now, I happen to know what that means, but there's other words, you know, that are used in common vernacular cliches that, you know, like, hey, like, well, man, hey, like, well, that's really cool. What the hell does temperature have to do with something that you desire or want or you approve of? People today commonly say, oh, that's groovy. What do ridges have to do, or holes, or trenches have to do with your desk or with your calculator? You know, hey, that's really groovy. Hey, that's really cool. So see, we use these words inappropriately. We're not talking about temperature or physical condition of the desktop. We're trying to describe how we feel about something. We like it. It's very desirable. Well, in law, when we're talking about insurance, we're talking about limited liability. And limited liability is the opposite of strict liability. And limited and strict liability have totally different legal outcomes. Now, you probably have some children, and when you had these children, you probably got a birth certificate, and attached to the birth certificate, there's a presumption of marriage with a marriage license, and this is called a fiction of law. See, if you're in a conversation with somebody, and you say, well, how many children do you have, and you say, three, do you ever say to somebody, are you married? You wouldn't ask somebody, are you married, after they've already told you they've got three children. They may not be, and here in America, they probably aren't. But the presumption is, this thing in law we call the fiction of law, the presumption is, well, the guy must be married, got three children. If you said that you had two children, and the conversation devolved upon what is their sex, and you said, I have one boy, would you say, well, what is the other one? Once you have established that you have two children, and once you have established that the sex of one of the two children is male, do you need to ask, what is the sex of the other child? You see, we can deduce, we can conclude the sex of the other child. And that's what judges do. That's what constitutions do. And as a result of that, we have conclusions in law that are predicated upon presumptions of law. And these presumptions, these fictions, these operations lead to legal conclusions. And this is why we call this pleading. Sometimes you need to plead out of a fiction of law. Pleading out. How do you want to plead out on this? Most people think, well, I want to cop a plea. Doesn't have anything to do with copping a plea and plea bargaining over here. We're talking about code pleading. But, you know, people out in the general population, they have their view of the meanings and terms and conditions of law. And then we have the lawyers, who typically hold positions of power in our legislatures. They're called politicians. Or in judgeships, and there usually are judges also. And these people have a different vocabulary than you do. They have a different take on the meaning of various words. And because those of us who call ourselves lay people, non-lawyers, and the lawyers out there have a difference in the way we speak and the definitions of the words that we use, it's pretty important that you understand what these words means, what these words mean, and what their definitions are. All right, so let's take a look at this. Bond servitude is distinct from slavery. A bond servant is somebody who voluntarily, with his own hand, signs a piece of paper, signs a contract, testifies to his fealty to his master. So in the Middle Ages, a man would kneel on one knee before his master and swear his allegiance to him. And he put himself into bond servitude. Now, he may do that for a number of reasons. He's poor. He wants a job. The master has something to offer for him. When you go into the army, you do this. The army is a master-servant, bond servitude relationship. And you sign an enlistment contract. It's not slavery. Military service is not slavery. It's something. It's something different than being an individual, a free man. But it's something that is short of being a slave. And so he signs a contract, and he does it for a reason. He wants the educational benefits. He wants the adventure. He wants the travel. He wants the, you know, whatever it is you wanted out of the Army, the Navy, or the Marines, you got when you enlisted. You turned yourself into a bondservant. Now, let's suppose that this bondservant, now that he's in the Army, has a change of heart, or he has a free spirit or something like that. And somebody in authority comes to him and says, peel potatoes. And he says, go to hell, I ain't peeling potatoes. Well, now here comes punishment. I've never had a sergeant come up to me and tell me, go peel potatoes or go do anything. I've never been in the military. But I can understand the military and military law, and I understand how it fits into our Constitution, and it's something different than the Fourth Amendment and Fifth Amendment. You know, if you're in the Army and some guy in authority comes to you and says, hey, open your footlocker, I want to inspect it, and you say, go get a search warrant, you know, that doesn't fly well there, that dog don't hunt. But it does out here in the real world. Now, you hire these people that are in authority in the Army, and you make them deputy sheriffs and policemen. And then, you know, he stops you and he says, hey, I want to search your attaché case, or I'm going to search your house or your car. And you say, no, sir, would you go get a search warrant? And he just comes unhinged. He doesn't understand that search warrant crap. And so he grabs you, throws you on the ground, handcuffs you, kicks you a couple of times in the ribs, you know, kind of teach you some civility here to superior authority. And then the rest of us civilians are sitting out here saying, hey, where'd that animal come from? And he doesn't seem to understand civil rights. And well, that's because he's from the army, and from his perspective in life, he doesn't know much about civil rights because he was never taught anything about civil rights. Command, chain of command, authority, power, he understands all of that. But civil rights, maybe he doesn't understand search warrants and things like that. Now, I don't think that most parents in their relationship with their children understand this guardian ward relationship that they have with a third party here called the state. And where social lady comes into the picture, and where the policeman comes into the picture, and where the teacher and the school comes into the picture, and where corporal punishment and discipline and child rearing, you know, all of these things come into the picture here. And as I mentioned, you know, here we have a Muslim man. He comes to the United States. I think he was Lebanese, as I recall. He has a wife. He has other children. And in fact, when he killed his daughter, two of his oldest boys were holding her while he administered the coup de grace and killed her. I forgot how they did. I think they cut her throat, bled her to death. Now, to those of us in the West, we sit over here and we listen to a story like that and we say, oh my God, I can't imagine a father doing that to his child. See? But then you can't imagine living in a polygamous family where one man has three wives. You know, to you, and from your upbringing and your religious training and legal education, you know, that's really wild and bizarre. Polygamy has been going on for thousands of years. In fact, polygamy, in case you didn't know, was originated by the same creator God. You know, the guy that did the Garden of Eden trick, you know, and invented Adam and Eve, you know. Yeah, that's the guy right there. You know, he also invented slavery, in case you didn't know that. The same God, he invented a social status called slavery. He invented bond servitude. Adam and Eve did not invent bond servitude, slavery, parens patriae. No, they didn't know that. So somebody in a superior power position creates your laws. Now, if you live in Texas, it's the state legislature of Texas. They meet every day down in Austin, Texas. And they have a death penalty down there in Texas. And they actually take people out of society. They just take you right out of society. And they take you into a room and strap you down and kill you. And this is called the police power of the state. Most people are familiar with that. Not all states have the death penalty, but there are some that do, at least here in the United States. And that death penalty power comes from a superior authority. I don't have that power. You know, if you're living in Texas, you don't have that power. I mean, if you go out here and decide, well, that guy needs killing, and you kill him, that's called murder. Could be a lesser brand of murder, like manslaughter or second or third degree or something like that. But there's a law out here, and we got this law from God that says, you shall do no murder. And we have a law that says, thou shalt not steal. And primarily, we follow a lot of those laws still. Those laws came from Moses at Mount Sinai, and we still follow a lot of those. We've abolished a lot, too. See, we have another one of the Ten Commandments says, thou shalt not commit adultery. So that legislature down there in Austin, Texas, they decided that the law that said, thou shalt not commit adultery, which is a capital felony, and the people that practice that ought to be put to death, they came to the conclusion, no, that's not kind and gentle. And so they passed a law, and they said, no, adultery's fine. Or something less than the death penalty. Maybe they didn't say it was fine, but they certainly came to the conclusion that killing people for adultery wasn't good public policy, and so they changed that law. Now, what that illustrates to us is that there's a conflict between this God, the guy that did the Adam and Eve trick in the Garden of Eden, and the legislature of Austin, Texas, or the legislature of Texas, in their construction or in their application of these laws. That's what we're really dealing with here. Now, we have this God. This is the Garden of Eden God now again. He came up to the conclusion that parents were pretty important in the chain of command in families, just like sergeants are very important in the chain of command in the military. And the police power of the state is very important in maintaining civil order in an organized society. So, you know, if you're a politician or a policeman out there and you're saying this guy Gordon is an anarchist, and you know, that's not true. That's not true at all. I'm sometimes referred to as a tax protester. That's not true. I'm not protesting any tax. Never have, don't now, and I hope I never do. And I'm not in the political realm, but also I'm not an anarchist. I understand the chain of command. I understood my Aunt Bessie and the switch fully. Hell, by the time I was 5 years old, I could figure that out. And that's why I've said, you know, earlier in the series, I said, you know, children are smarter than dogs. You know, you can train your dog, but, you know, you can't train your kid. Your kid's totally out of control. And this out-of-control child grows up and gets to be a big out-of-control child. And then pretty soon you have a great big out-of-control adult, you know, like Rodney King. I understand that. And then the policemen, you know, they're kind of adults, and they kind of get out of control sometimes. You know, policemen get out of control. Did you know that? Hell, all of us get out of control. And that's why my granddad said, you know, it's time for you to come down to Earth. My dad used to tell me that, too. You know, it's time for you to come back down to Earth. You're floating around out here in space someplace. You're a space case. And so to do that, in the old days, they used to administer some punishment, you know, pain. I described this pain thing over here when you're breaking a cow, breaking a horse, breaking a child, you know, you apply a little pain there, you know, spank his bottom, and he pretty soon he associates that pain with reward or with pain, you know, his activities, his actions. They do that in the Army. You know, if you're in the Army and they want to run you through basic training over here, they have a program by which they're going to train you, teach you to respond. So here's this sergeant, you know, this the training instructor, and he wants to train you for the military services, and he has an agenda, he has an outcome that he has in mind. And so he takes this civilian who has little or no discipline, little or no concept of the uniform code of military justice, and so he breaks his spirit, breaks him in. He's going to break him to be a soldier. He has to teach him how to salute. Hey, when you walk by me, boy, you stop and raise your arm to your eyebrow, and that's called salute. Let's try that. In homes, in the old days, they used to teach children that when you address your parents or an adult, you address them, yes, sir, and yes, ma'am. Then it was a sign of respect. It was a sign of a guardian ward. It was a master-servant relationship. So when a little child, you know, 5, 6, 8, 10 years old, came to Aunt Bessie, and Aunt Bessie said, wash your hands for dinner, and you didn't say, oh, do I have to? Because I never did say that to my Aunt Bessie, because I'd been trained early on, but I can assure you that had I said something like that to my Aunt Bessie, my God, I'm an adult, and I shuddered to think what would have happened. You know, you soldiers in the Army, if your sergeant says, hey, you, why didn't you salute? Oh, do I have to? What do you think is going to happen to you? Well, something very unpleasant. With my Aunt Bessie, it was the switch. You know, in the Army, maybe you're going to do 100 push-ups or something. Something bad, wicked, terrible, awful, and evil is going to occur to you that you don't want. And this then, when you associate these conditions in your life, you say, it's a whole lot easier to say, yes, ma'am, than it is to say, oh, do I have to, and suffer some traumatic event, like getting whipped or slapped around or go to bed without dinner or something like that. So, training. So that's why I mentioned earlier training. Now, who is going to do this training? Who has the authority? Who has the power to do this training? Well, in the Army, it's the authorities, the sergeants, you know, typically. And in the family, it's typically the parents. And in the state, it's called the Highway Patrol or the police. Now, there's a phenomenon that has occurred here in the United States, and I suppose in Canada and Western Europe and Australia and New Zealand, a phenomenon has occurred here. That parenting, that is, the decisions that parents used to make concerning their children, including life and death, from the Bible, have now been changed. And now we have social lady and teacher in the mix. And we have the legislature describing to us what we can do and cannot do in regards to our children. You know, for instance, here in the United States, thou shalt not kill thy son or daughter because of their wayward behavior. So we have eliminated the death penalty as it relates to children administered by parents. But I wanted to remind you that that power at one time existed, and that power that did exist came from no other authority than the creator of the universe himself, the same guy that came up with this Ten Commandment idea. That's the guy that thought up capital punishment for children. All right, we'll take this up when we get through with our reminder here that you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. And The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 112 countries daily over the internet and radio. For more information about the law school and The Law Hour, please go to our website. That's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Now, the law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. Now, that's 8 schools in all. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals, but by prearrangement. Now, the law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc, and the Law Hour website is updated every week. It has a radio log schedule and archives, and that can be accessed to the website as well at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the internet by title and date for your listening convenience. And the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Now, the law school offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order yours by calling the law school at 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, these opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone. They don't necessarily represent the views, the beliefs, or the opinions of the advertisers, sponsors, management, or the staff of this radio network or of this local radio station. Now, if you'd like more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, please go to our website. Remember, that's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. You can call us direct at 417-273-4967. All right, we're talking about incorrigible delinquency. And there are some aspects to it here, like the doctrine of parens patriae that comes into play. Now, I mentioned a little earlier, I said, well, who owns that child? Now, the presumption under the Ten Commandments is that the parent owns the child. After all, it's with mom and dad that created this little baby. So the creator of the universe, pursuant to the Ten Commandments, came up with a number of statutes. I went through a bunch of those child-rearing statutes. You know, to spare the rod is to spoil the child. Now, that isn't what you get from your state legislature or Dr. Spock or from your school teacher or social lady. They tell you, don't you touch that kid. Let that kid grow up like a wild weed, which is why, you know, sergeants in boot camp have such a hard time training these critters that they get out of civil society. Most of them don't have any concept of this chain of command authority from the top down. And this kid, you know, he's been playing video games and he's been watching TV. He's been a couch potato. Mom says, wash for dinner. And he says, ah, do I have to? And so he comes into the Army. And this sergeant over here is trying to train this kid to be a soldier. And he says, ah, do I have to? You see, and he doesn't understand this thing called chain of command. You know, they needed to learn that somewhere. I learned that thing called chain of command from my daddy, and I related that to you here in a former program. I said, my dad taught me to sit in a chair. I don't know how old I was, no, 2, 3, 4 years old. He taught me my drills. You know, he'd say, come here, go there, stand up, sit down, bring me that paper, bring me my slippers, sit in that chair. And I showed you, I sat in a chair one time, and this was, you know, kind of a family story. And my dad had not come back to say, okay, you can get out of the chair now. So I curled up and went to sleep, and 3, 4, 5 hours later, I don't know how long it was, but quite a long time later, there I was asleep in the chair. And my dad then said, well, I forgot to tell him to get out. Well, I had already learned the trick. See, I didn't ask, ah, do I have to? It was just, yes, sir. Sit in the chair, yes, sir. That's a dream for all you sergeants out there, isn't it? You know, you say, son, do this, yes, sir. And he does it, just automatically. Well, what would you think if you had a child, and you said, son, your hair is too long, get it cut tomorrow. Yes, sir. And, you know, you come sit down at the table tomorrow night, and here's your son. He's sitting there at the table, and his hair's cut. When I was a boy, when your hair touched your ears, it was too long. And a haircut in those days was 50 cents. When I was a kid, it was 4 bits. And so my dad, you know, would hand me the 4 bits and say, your hair is too long. Get it cut. Yes, sir. Now, he didn't tell me when to get it cut. He just said, get it cut. Now, he left it up to me to make that decision. If something came up the next day, and for some reason I was in school or after school work or doing something, and maybe I didn't get my hair cut, and we sat down at the dinner table, he would say, son, didn't I tell you to get your hair cut? And the response would be, yes, sir. Well, was there some reason why you didn't get it cut? And then I would say, well, I was working after school, and or I got kept after school, or something happened, and I had to have a reason. This is the law. You know, it's if you're going to break the law, you got to have a reason why. And so my dad would typically let it pass, and he would say, okay, well, take care of it. Ladies and gentlemen, I never did come back the second time and come up with a second, third, fifth, ninth, or 11th, or 16th excuse. If dad asked me why it wasn't done, that meant if I have to speak to you yet a third time. See, there was just kind of this unwritten, you know, this doesn't happen three times, you know. You can do it once, and you can probably do it twice, but if you do this the third time, there's going to be weeping, wailing, and gnashing of teeth. So in the world that I grew up in, there was consequences. There was a penalty. There was a conclusion to this matter. There never was any question about whether or not your hair is going to get cut. That's a given. The hair is going to be cut. I never raised the subject matter of why can't I have my hair down around my neck? Why can't I wear hair like girls? Why can't I have pigtails like Sally? That was never a part of the discussion. I wasn't a lawmaker. My dad was a lawmaker, and he told me that one time. He said, I'm King Edward. I'm King Edward, your mother's Queen Mildred, and you are a subject. He used the word subject, not citizen, subject. I make the laws, your mother implements those laws, and you sit down, shut up, fold your hands, and do what you're told. Okay. That's the way it really works out here in the real world. And when social lady tells you something, you know, when the policeman, the teacher tells you something, when the civil authorities tell you, see, you moms and dads out there, you know that you ought not to spank your children. You learned that from the child. Hell, you were never spanked. Half you people out there listening to me don't know what a whipping is. Or as they say down here in the South, a whooping. Now you're sitting there saying, well, I didn't shoot anybody off the street corners. Well, that's good. And probably most of us don't. That's because we're not shooting people off the street corners because we're afraid of the police and we're afraid of what might happen. We're afraid of prison and 15 other reasons why. But there's always a certain element of people out there. They're not afraid. And if you don't fear that power over there, well, you're probably going to break the law. You're probably going to test that power. Now, if you do that in the boot camp, you know, then the sergeant, he's going to do something over here that's going to be very unpleasant. If you do this in front of Aunt Bessie, she's going to do something very unpleasant. And then that's what discipline's all about. So when a slave doesn't do what he's told, then there's something that's very unpleasant that happens to him. Most of us learn that early on. Most of us can recognize that chain of command. There's always a few that can't. That's why you have to have policemen. That's why you got to have sergeants. That's why you got to have laws, the rules and regulations, customs, usages, and practices. That's to keep society on an even keel, you know, so that I'm not running out here stealing your lawnmower, you know, and hitting you over the head and stealing your purse. Now, most of us recognize and understand that. But getting back here now to the incorrigible delinquent over here, some of them don't. So what do you do when you've got a child who's an incorrigible delinquent? And so I read to you those two statutes here in the Bible. You took them out and you killed them. Today we don't do that. Today, when a child, and I pointed this out, two little girls went out and burned their school, didn't burn it down, but they set fire to it, caused $100,000 worth of damage in the fifth grade, 10 years old. The parents aren't responsible for that, and the juvenile authority stepped in. Here comes teacher, here comes social lady, here comes probation officer, here comes juvenile court. And they're taking these two girls out of this home, their home, to different families. Here are these two families, just lost one of their children. And the child is now taken into juvenile custody, locked up in juvenile court, and there's a juvenile judge, and there's all these other people over here from the civil law state out of Austin, Texas, that are going to decide what we're going to do. What's the punishment for these two little girls? And are we going to allow these two little girls to continue in these two families, in these two homes? And they may come to the conclusion, no, these parents aren't too good, so we're going to remove them, put them in foster care, put them up for adoption, do something else, and we're going to just change their parents. But they're not going to kill them. You can rest assured they're not going to kill them. So put that out of your mind. But in ancient times, it could have been. And I'll tell you who was responsible for the fire. See, back in the days of Moses, if these two girls had caused $100,000 damage, they would have divided the damage between the two girls, $50,000 each, gone to the parents and said, you owe $50,000, pay up. So the penalty for the damage falls on the parents. And that's called strict liability. Strict liability, no insurance. Today, we have limited liability. And that's why you got a birth certificate and a marriage license. Did you know that? Probably nobody ever explained it to you. But for whatever reason, you decided that you weren't competent and capable of supporting your family, of training and teaching your children. Because strict liability would require that you, personally, Dad, be responsible for all the damages caused by your children. And for some reason, you figured out that you probably couldn't teach and train these girls not to burn the school down. And so you wanted limited liability, and you got it. You got a marriage license, and you brought in a third party. That's the state of Texas. And you have a three-party limited general partnership between you, your wife, and the state of Texas. And the state of Texas, the lawmaker, the superior in this case, the superior partner, the guardian, will decide what laws we're going to follow. Evidently, you couldn't create laws. Like in my family, when I was a kid growing up, we had laws like yes, ma'am, and no, ma'am, and come here and go there and stand up and sit down. There were laws. You had to practice those. Then, as time went on, the state got into the picture. In fact, it started in 1876 when Illinois started this marriage license program, which is a derivative of the 14th Amendment now. So if you want to know, well, where did this marriage license thing come from? It came from Illinois in 1876, and it's derived from the 14th Amendment. It's one of the Reconstruction Amendments after the Civil War. Now, the states added another factor to this, a little factoid here. They added birth certificates. And so if you look up this registration, you know, you're going to register your child's birth with the state. And what does that do? What legal effect does this have? All right, let me show you what the legal effect is. Here's an example in one of my classes when we're talking about this thing of guardian ward, for instance. On Monday, May the 19th, 1986, this question was put to Mr. Jim Maddox, the Attorney General of the state of Texas. So now picture this. Now here's a guy walks up to the Attorney General and he says, Mr. Attorney General, Chief Judicial Officer of the state of Texas. And he's not really. The Chief Justice is the Chief Judicial Officer, but the Attorney General is the head law enforcement officer. That's the term we need to apply to him. He's the Chief Law Enforcement Officer. You know, he's a pretty high-ranking guy, a fellow that probably knows the law pretty well. Now, remember, this question is it true that the state of Texas owns our children? Very simple, straightforward. And so he's asking a leading question. He didn't ask, who owns our children? He didn't ask, does the state of Texas own our children? Or do I own my child? He worded it this way. He said, is it true that? Now, this is a presumption here. It's an assumption. It is assuming facts that aren't in evidence. And so he's going to ask the Attorney General, is it true? I've heard this made. I've heard this said. It's been told to me that the state of Texas owns my child. Is it true that the state of Texas owns our children? So here's the Attorney General's response. He said, yes, it is true. And not only your children, but you too. Did you grasp that? Let's think about that for a minute. Here's an adult walks up to the chief law enforcement officer of the state of Texas. And he says, is it true that the state of Texas owns our children? And the Attorney General says, yes, that is true. And let me add, we not only own your children, but we own you also. We own you and your children. Let's go back here to my dad. My dad says to me, you are grounded. You are not riding your bicycle for a week. Now, had you come to me and asked me whose bicycle is that, I would have said it's mine. And it came to me by gift. And my dad gave me that bicycle at Christmas. It was a Ward's Riverside, $85 in 1950. I mean, this is a big, heavy, expensive bicycle. It was the best and biggest and most expensive Ward's sold in 1950. Deluxe. Had a horn and a light. See? And white sidewall tires. Now, here's the point. I said, that's my bicycle. I received it by gift. I'm 11 years old. My dad says, you're grounded and I'm taking that bike away from you. Excuse me. Who owns that bike? My dad owns that bike. And he owns it by virtue of the fact that he owns me. Well, at least he thought he did. Now, he really didn't, but he thought he did. And as a result of that, he, who owned me, also owned the bike, and he, who owned me, could take my bike away from me. He could administer punishment. All right, let's take this a step further. Well, then, if the state owns you, could the state take your child away from you like my dad took my bike away from me? And the answer is yes, they can, and they do. They do that 2 million times a year. The state, if they just come right into families, people's homes, and take those children away from them. And if you give them any static about it, they'll kill you and take them away from you. If that's what it takes. I mean, you know, normally it doesn't take that, but once in a while it does. You know, once in a while people get uppity and they say, well, you're not going to come in here and take my child. And then, you know, the sheriff comes out with a SWAT team and they say, well, okay, you know, we'll give it to you any way you want it. So I just wanted to point out to you that, you know, there's some laws out here and rules and regulations. Maybe you don't understand this. Maybe you didn't, you know, you were unable to figure out how this chain of command worked, but I wanted to explain it to you because this is all part and parcel of this juvenile delinquency thing. Parents here in the United States are working under a real handicap. You can't spank your kid because if you spank your kid, you know as well as I do that the kid's going to report it to the teacher in turn is going to report it to the social lady, social lady's going to call a cop, they're going to come out the house, take the kid and put him in foster care. You know that. And so that's why you're really deep down inside afraid to discipline this kid. I mean, you know, the kid's 5 years old, 8 years old, 10 years old, and you're sitting there cringing. And this is why God said, you know, the day will come when children will be your oppressors. There's a reason why your children are oppressing you. It's because you don't have any authority over them. And that's because they're not your children. That's the kicker. They're not yours. So now the question arises, well, whose are they? Well, the Attorney General just told you. The Attorney General showed you. He said, yes, it's true, the state of Texas owns your children. Not only your kids, but you too. You know, you're an adult. You're an adult. How in the world does the state get title to you, your body? Where'd they get that? And where did the state get title to your child? Where did this change come? When? How did this happen? It hasn't always been that way. Well, President Lincoln created a document called the Emancipation Proclamation, which was then followed up by the 13th Amendment. It's against the law in this country to own bondservants. Well, not exactly. There are some bondservants in this country. Sports stars are bondservants. Sports stars. I was always impressed by a guy one time. He was being interviewed. He's a pitcher with the New York Yankees, and he'd been traded to the Seattle Mariners. And this reporter comes up to him and says, well, what do you think about this trade? You know, you used to play ball for the New York Yankees. Now you're going to go out to Seattle, Washington, play for the Mariners. And he said, I did not know that I had been traded until I read it in the paper. I did not know that I had been traded. How in the hell do you trade human beings? Huh? Where does that come from? It's called bond servitude. It comes from the Bible. It comes from this God, you know, that did the Adam and Eve trick. He's the guy that thunk it up, not me. I'm just a reporter. Just came here to tell you that's where it came from. And the distinction between a bondservant and a slave is that a slave is taken into bond servitude against his will and over his objection, but a bondservant is somebody that signs up and signs a contract. So when you signed up to join the army, you're a bondservant, not a slave. You weren't taken in there against your will and over your objection. Nobody has ever been taken into the military services in the United States of America against his will and over his objection. Never happened. Now watch, somebody's going to write me a letter and say, have you heard of the draft you've done? Draft? Draft? Yeah, I've heard of a draft. Draft is voluntary. Didn't you know that, son? Now somebody's going to say, well, I was drafted into the army. Hell, so was my dad. But it was voluntary. Well, but how can that be? You know, there's a lot that goes on that we don't seem to understand. When I tell my students, I say, the state of Texas owns your child. They gasp. No, that's not true. I'm the father. I created that child. That's true. You did. But you don't own him. Well, then when did title transfer? With the birth certificate. Birth certificate. But ownership of the child was a three-party limited general partnership the day the child was born because you had a marriage license when you got married and you created a three-party limited general partnership between the boy, the girl, and the state. The state owned one-third of the child the day he was born. Then the state approached you other two parties and said, why don't you give the kid to me? Give up your two-thirds interest in the child. Register this birth. Let's go through a legal process here, a legal adoption. I will own the child, but I'll let you keep him. You can buy braces for his teeth. You can dress him and clothe him. And educate him in my school. I want you to educate him here in my school. Then I'll direct his education through the 10 planks to the Communist Manifesto. In my school, the 10th plank to the Communist Manifesto. And I will teach sex education in opposition to thou shalt not commit adultery. And then you said, okay, sounds like a good idea to me. And that's what you did. And that's why you lost control of your child. And you lost ownership to the child when you got the marriage license. And you lost total ownership of the child when you got the birth certificate. Social lady is the agent of the state who administers the state's interest in a guardian-ward relationship over the child. And the state's public policy is to destroy the family. That's why we have marriage licenses. The plot here, the program is to destroy the family. Now, if the state came to you and said, we want to destroy your family, see, you wouldn't buy into that. So they come to you, and the cover story is, we want to protect the family. And it's like the war on drugs. You know, we have this war on drugs. We want to stamp out drugs. You got more drugs today than you had before you started the war on drugs. Why are we going to Afghanistan? To stamp out drugs. No, no. You went to Afghanistan to recreate the drug trade in Afghanistan because the Taliban had already stamped out drugs. In fact, Afghanistan now has the highest drug crop, the most drug production in the history of the country. They've never produced as much heroin as they are here in the year 2006, 7, and 8. Bumper crops, huge crops, under American occupation. Hell, the whole thing was stamped out under the Taliban. You mean to tell me a bunch of dumb hillbillies riding camels through the deserts of Afghanistan can stamp out heroin, and when the sophisticated American army drives out the camel jockeys, takes over the country, and drug trafficking grows to the highest level in the history of the country? Huh? Well, come on, wake up. Smell the coffee here. You got the highest level of juvenile delinquency in the history of America with birth certificates and marriage licenses and the cover story. Oh, we're just here to prevent juvenile delinquency and promote the family. That's why the state's involved. Anybody that believes that's a candidate for buying the Brooklyn Bridge. All right. Now, I wanted to bring this to your attention over here because there is a God in heaven, and this guy came up with some pretty logical, pretty down-to-earth laws concerning children and concerning your relationship with the state and marriage licenses and birth certificates. He said, you know, he told you, he said, you shall have no other gods before me. And the state of Texas is a god. The state of Texas is a sovereign, and you worship the state of Texas by obeying the law of the state of Texas. That makes you an idolater. That's a violation of the first commandment. That's our first problem, idolatry. And then the state, that is your neighbors over here that you elected, you know, are now making your laws for you. And these laws are creating, causing, they are the root problem with juvenile delinquency. Hey, I'm out of time here. I got to give you a reminder here that you have been listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 112 countries worldwide daily over the internet and radio. For more information about the law school and The Law Hour, then please go to our website at georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that is open to individuals, but by prearrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc, and the Law Hour website is updated weekly and has a radio log schedule and archives, and all of it can be accessed through our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. All right, time's up. We got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station, God willing. So until then, thanks for listening, everybody, and good night, friends.